Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
Last June marked the 23rd anniversary of New York's Stonewall Riots. Next Sunday is Vancouver's Pride Parade. The years in between have seen transitions from gay liberation to gay rights, same-sex marriages to TV shows and personalities, the AIDS epidemic to gays in the military, emerging social movements mean even more changes. For many, the Stonewall riots stand as an inspiration and point in the right direction. And to help us understand what Stonewall means today, we've contacted Michael Bronski. Michael is a longtime activist, journalist, and visiting scholar at Dartmouth University. Hello, Michael. It's a pleasure to have you on Red Eye today.
Hi, Lori.
Maybe you could begin by taking us back to the Stonewall in those 3 days in New York, 1969, and outline what happened.
Sure. I want to say I'm probably the only person who lived in New York or New Jersey on that weekend who was openly gay and does not claim to have been at the Stonewall riots. So I actually was not there. But I think that... Let me give a brief rundown of what happened. In New York at the time, it was quite common for gay bars, most of which were owned by underworld mafia types, to be raided by the police, who were not so much into harassing the patrons, although that clearly happened, but of getting bribed, bribing the owners so that they would not keep raiding the bars. So when the Stonewall Inn was raided that night, it was probably one of three raids that happened that June. It was not unusual for raids to happen. What was unusual was that the patrons in the bar and out on the street began to fight back. And they managed, within about half an hour, to lock the police in the bar. So we had the situation where the police were in the bar fighting to get out, and the people outside, who were a mixture of some drag queens, some sort of collegiate type, some neighborhood people, were actually outside throwing rocks and even a parking meter at the bar. This ignited a much larger street fight. The fire department came, the other policemen came, and probably by the end of that night, there were over 700 people out on the street in front of the bar. This was repeated for the next two nights as well. So when we talk about the riots, it really is a three-night event, and pretty rowdy.
Sounds very wild. Now we know that radical gay movements had existed both before and after Stonewall. How was Stonewall a defining moment for those movements?
Well, I think it was a defining moment because the movements before Stonewall were actually what in America we would call the homophile movements, which were, you know, pretty effective political groups that were looking for acceptance by the mainstream social and legal groups. So they were what we now call assimilationist groups. Mm-hmm. They did not approve of people throwing rocks at the police at all.
Was there a sense of being sort of apologist on the part of people in those movements?
I would say apologist. I mean, it was quite common for them to invite psychiatrists to their meetings to tell the gay people at the meetings that they could be cured. So the homophile movements were not particularly what we would call radical or even progressive. What Stonewall did was that it actually marked the point at which gay people fought back. And within 2 weeks of the riots, the Gay Liberation Front was formed in New York, which was GLF, of which I actually was a member of. And that was very, very much a radical grassroots, let's get out on the streets and have social change sort of movement. So the Stonewall riots were sort of the key that opened up that brand new way of looking at gay politics.
And this was in 1969, which was the peak of the anti-Vietnam War movement. And the new left had emerged as a force there. How did Stonewall fit into all of this?
Well, it's interesting. There's a way in which the lesbian gay historians and the lesbian gay movement has sort of made a fetish out of Stonewall, that it happened. It was this sort of ignition of incredible anger that happened out of nowhere. But having lived in New York during that time, the reality is that Stonewall was really one more instance and one more part of a broad tapestry of other social movements, all of which were out on the street. So we have huge anti-war, anti-Vietnam protests. We have Black Panther protests. We have the feminist, which was then called Women's Liberation Front, protests, monthly out on the streets. The other thing that people overlook, I think, is that, New York street culture was very active. It really was, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The David Bowie was the Rolling Stones. It was hippies living out on the street. So when Stonewall happened, it actually was fairly easy to get 700 to 1,000 people out there every night. People were actually used to going to demonstrations and riots. It was simply part of the culture. Not true now, except with the globalization protests, perhaps. But much, much more true back then.
And I understand that some of the empowering terms from gay liberation took their names from existing social movements.
Completely. I mean, certainly the notion that gay was good was just an adaptation of Black is Beautiful. And Gay Liberation Front took its name from Women's Liberation Front, which in turn had taken its name from National Liberation Front, which was the Viet Cong group, which in turn had taken its name from the fight in Algeria. So the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Liberation Movement was completely tied up with these other social movements. And I think it's hard for people, younger people now, maybe today, to think of this, but back then, when we had the Gay Liberation March, it was as much to fight for the rights of gay people, to be open, to end the war in Vietnam, to fight for the right to have an abortion, to fight for welfare reform, and to fight to end racism. The early marches were not about what we would call now gay and lesbian rights, or GLBT rights. It was conceived of as part of a much broader social change agenda. That's obviously changed.
Well, let's look at some of those changes and some of the transitions to today's queer movements and GLBT movement. Stonewall ignited a movement for gay rights, which you've written elsewhere is based on behavior, and then organizing eventually shifted to focus on identity. Can you kind of draw out the differences in these two approaches?
Sure. I think, just to backtrack for a moment, I think when we talk about the gay liberation movement, as much as I am, that I was part of that and committed to it, I have to admit that it lasted for about a year before it turned into the gay rights movement, which was pretty much only focused upon was a fight for equality under the law to give gay people the same rights as heterosexuals. But what happened during that change was that people dropped the notion that being homosexual was about having sex. And the whole idea of a public, not people having sex on the street corner, although sometimes in the village that might happen, but in fact the notion of people having identity based on their sexual behavior rather than just an identity that they had, which they then wanted to use to have sex in private, was a very big change that happened right after Stonewall, about a year after. Did that get to your question?
Yeah. What kind of factors do you think contributed to this shift? And I mean, I think some of the queer movements have have really given identity a lot of room in what they're fighting for. What do you think caused what were the reasons for these shifts?
Well, I think part of the shift was that the original Gay Liberation Front was really, like myself, people who came from the New Left movements, people who were in radical social change movements, who were gay but who now were organizing the same way around gay or queer issues. As the movement became larger, as it should have, of course, it really attracted a broad base of people, not only from radical backgrounds, but from middle class and upper middle class backgrounds as well. And I don't mean to criticize the people, but by necessity, when a movement becomes larger and grows quickly, its agenda changes and becomes far less threatening. So I think that the early fight, which was connected to other movements for radical change and around sexuality, then completely changed to a much more conservative mainstream fight, which was not to look for liberation or freedom, but to look for acceptance.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the recent struggles and also changes that have taken place, for instance, here, I know there's been struggles around gay rights in the military, and recently in Canada, just a couple of weeks ago, same-sex marriage has been legalized here in the province where we are. What do you think are the benefits and the limitations of these rights?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I'm in the middle of writing an article about same-sex marriage now. Clearly, anyone who comes from a liberationist and progressive background, I think, would have to admit that there should be equality under the law. So if there's such a thing as heterosexual marriage, there should be one for same-sex marriage. If heterosexuals can go into or have to go into the military, there's no reason, as much as we may abhor the military, there's no reason to exclude homosexuals. But from my perspective, we've actually, in the U.S. anyway, we've become a movement that's obsessed with equality, and we've lost a larger vision of how to change the world. One of my favorite signs at the first Gulf War protest back in 91 was a sign that said, "The problem isn't gay soldiers, the problem is dead soldiers."
Right.
So clearly, in 1969, there was no question that being part of the gay movement meant you were against the war in Vietnam. Now we have a gay rights movement, which is insisting that gay people be allowed to fight in the military and go to Iraq. And, you know, clearly there should be equality. But to lose track of the larger picture, which is that, gee, maybe war is bad and the military kills people, seems to me ultimately rather short-sighted.
I'm interested in hearing from you how you think these sort of continued struggles to liberate gay people, transgendered people, and so forth, how they can link in with current struggles and not just be seen as a separate struggle.
Well, I think they can. I don't see a lot of people doing it right now. Certainly, I mean, a good example of where people are working on this is the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force in the United States has a policy institute, and they have just issued a report about welfare reform in the United States, which is essentially a draconian conservative cutback on, this must be totally foreign to Canadian or UK listeners, you know, totally cutting back on the state helping poor people. The report from the Policy Institute pointed out in how many ways this report hurt gay and lesbian families much worse than it hurt heterosexual families. And they were really doing organizing around the fact that if you cared about queer people and queer families, you should fight against this welfare reform. So I do believe there are instances in which we can bring these two struggles together. I mean, certainly it seems to me that if popular sentiment in the U.S. continues to rise against the war in Iraq, we could make a good argument that the gay movement should be against military actions that kill everybody, including gay soldiers who are obviously in the army now.
I want to talk a little bit more about gay marriage, because as you're working on your article, and we've been thinking about it here because a lot is happening here just because all of a sudden British Columbia, Vancouver has become a place where gay people come to get married, either from other provinces, from the States, different countries, or people who have been here get married. And I, like you, think that I'm happy that there is that sense of equality between gay folks, lesbian folks, and straight folks. But I also question, is there something that can be lost here in terms of gay culture and what, you know, maybe a fresh insight that we could bring to relations between people as a result of saying, okay, well, we can get married like everyone else.
Sure. Well, I think it's interesting. What fascinates me, really fascinates me endlessly, is all of the lesbians I know who are working for same-sex marriage are all about my age, which is 53, 54, and I'm actually 54, I'm not bridging it, and they are the very women that came of age and came out in the late 60s, the early 70s, when they had a very strong feminist critique of marriage as really being, besides often a dangerous place for women and children, really being not the best way to arrange our personal relationships. And it surprised me that we've actually lost this feminist critique of marriage, which really was about sexual freedom and personal liberation back then. And we're now focusing on the fact that being married is not only a good thing, but it's the only way that we can have a satisfying relationship. And I think one of the strengths of GLBT, and particularly in the early 70s of gay and lesbian relationships, is that the gay and lesbian community really offered to heterosexuals who were often trapped in terrible marriages a whole new vision of how they might live their lives. You know, I'm not talking about going out to a bar and tricking with somebody every night, but, you know, a new way of looking at relationships that might give people more freedom and more of a sense of themselves. Relationships that people entered into willingly and did not feel forced into by their parents or social structures or social agendas. So I think there's a way what we've lost is really a valuing of gay and lesbian culture as offering really a wide variety of alternative relationship strategies. And we've sort of said, well, you're right, marriage is the best way, and let's just all get married now. What I'll find most interesting, if we break down to the old stereotypes of, you know, lesbians engage in 2-year-long relationships and then break up and do a sort of serial monogamy, and gay men do nothing but go out 3 times a week and trick with new people and never have boyfriends. I'll be very interested if that behavior really changes when these people get married, whether we'll not see lesbian serial marriage and gay men in relationships that are completely and totally sexually open to other people.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen, and it's uncharted territory which we can all engage in navigating.
And I really, speaking as someone who's been involved with the gay male community very much, I have a hard time thinking of men I know who are in relationships that are open relationships changing that if they happen to go to Vancouver and happen to get a marriage certificate. I don't think that piece of paper is going to make that much of a difference to them. But I think for so many people, it's the symbol and of the marriage. For people who have been literally outcast and scorned for so long that they're hungry and greedy to have social approval, no matter how they might live their lives anyway.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's been an interesting discussion.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Michael Bronski. Michael is a longtime activist, journalist, and he's a visiting scholar at Dartmouth University.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.